हरि
Chapter 9, Stay High Forever. Quote from the introduction to the text. But while this was going on, an old man, 1 year past, his allotted 70, 1 year past 70, so that means 71 years old, the score will be 20. Years, so 70 will be 60, and then 10 will be 70, and then 1 year past. So that's. But while this was going on, an old man, 1 year past his allotted 70, wandered into New York's East Village and set about to prove to the world that he knew where God could be found. In only 3 months, the man, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, The man, Swami A.C. Bhaktivedanta, succeeded in convincing the world's toughest audience, bohemians, acid heads, potheads, and hippies, that he knew the way to God, turn off, sing out, and fall in. This new brand of holy man, with all due deference to Dr. Leary, has come forth with a brand of consciousness expansion that's sweeter than acid, cheaper than pot, and non-bustable by fuzz. How is all this possible? Through Krishna, the Swami says, from the East Village Other. That's the newspaper. Okay. You need a translation? Or okay. Bohemians, those are like, they do whatever they like. They're into like intellectual kind of stuff, sit around. You know, they don't really follow what everybody else follows and all that, you know, at least in the way they think and that. Independent thinkers, acid heads, means they take a lot of LSD, so that's the only thing that they think about. Potheads, they take a lot of marijuana, and that's all they think about. And hippies means just, you know, these nice, free-loving, do whatever you want, dress however you want kind of people. Okay, so now here, this turn off, sing out, and fall in. That's a play on, what was it? I know it was turn on something and drop out. I can't remember, but. So turn on meant, you know, you take intoxication. So here he's saying he starts out with turn off, means you don't take intoxication. Sing out, you know, you're singing, and fall in instead of drop out. You drop out of the society, you know, you fall in line with all this stuff like this. And then in deference to Dr. Leary, because Dr. Leary is the one who synthesized or was the one synthesizing LSD like that. So in deference to him, then he's got a new brand of consciousness expansion, means how you can expand the consciousness without the drugs. So he was saying you have to do it with. And then sweeter than acid, that it's better than that. So then the acid they were saying was supposed to be so nice, but then we see it's not so nice, right? So it's cheaper than pot because you had to pay for that. So this one you don't have to pay for. right? And non-bustable by fuzz means you get busted, means you get caught by the fuzz. I mean, the fuzz of the police, excuse me. Okay, so yeah, so it's non-bustable by the fuzz means that the police couldn't catch you and take you to jail with it because it's completely legal to chant Hare Krishna. Prabhupada's health was good that summer and fall, or so it seemed. He worked long and hard, and except for 4 hours of rest at night, he was always active. He would speak intensively, on and on, never tiring, and his voice was strong. His smiles were strong and charming, his singing voice loud and melodious. During kirtan, he would thump Bengali mridanga beats on his bongo drum, sometimes for an hour. He ate heartily of rice, dal, chapatis, and vegetables with ghee. His face was full and his belly protuberant. Sometimes in a light mood, he would drum with two fingers on his belly and say that the residents affirmed his good health. Like that. That means just on the stomach, not on the navel. You never clap the navel and make a sound. It's very bad because that's where that's the knot that ties all the life airs in the body together. And so if you clap the navel like that, then it can disturb all the life airs. So this is just on the side they do that. His golden color, right? So if your appetite is good, you know, you have energy like that, everything is bright, then you know health is good, right? It's not by, you know, if you have a belly or not. That's a modern idea that if you have your six-pack or eight-pack or whatever, how many pack you want to pack in there, then that's supposed to be very, very good, right? But the point is that's not necessarily, that's what happens if you, you know, use weights and all that a lot, and then if you don't, does that make sense? Because after a while, then all these things cave in anyway, so. His golden color had the radiance of youth, and well-being, preserved by 7 years of healthy, non-destructive habits. When he smiled, virility and vitality came on so strong as to embarrass a faded, dissolute New Yorker. In many ways, he was not at all like an old man, and his new followers completely accepted his act of youthfulness as part of the wonder of Swamiji, just as they had come to accept the wonder of chanting and the wonder of Krishna. Swamiji wasn't an ordinary man. He was spiritual. He could do anything. None of his followers dared advise him to slow down, nor did it ever really occur to them that he needed such protection. They were busy just trying to keep up with him. You know, when Prabhupada would go on a walk in the morning, it was actually very difficult for all the devotees to keep up with him. He would walk so fast that even all the young devotees, they still were having trouble keeping up. Like that. During the 2 months at 26 Second Avenue, he had achieved what had formerly been only a dream. He now had a temple, a duly registered society, full freedom to preach, and a band of initiated disciples. When a godbrother had written asking him how he would manage a temple in New York, Prabhupada said that he would need men from India, but that he might find an American or two who could help. But that had been last winter. Now Krishna had put him in a different situation. He had received no help from his godbrothers, no big donations from Indian business magnates, and no assistance from the Indian government. But he was finding success in a different way. These were happy days, he said. He had struggled alone for a year, but then Krishna sent me men and money. Yes, these were happy days for Prabhupada, but his happiness was not like the happiness of an old man's sunset years, as he fades into the dim comforts of retirement. This was the happiness of youth, a time of blossoming, of new powers, a time when future hopes expand without limit. He was 71 years old, but in ambition, he was a courageous youth. He was like a young giant just beginning to grow. He was happy because his preaching was taking hold, just as Lord Chaitanya had been happy when he traveled alone to South India, spreading the chanting of Hare Krishna. Prabhupada's happiness was that of a selfless servant of Krishna, to whom Krishna was sending candidates for devotional life. He was happy to place the seed of devotion within their hearts and to train them in chanting Hare Krishna, hearing about Krishna, and working to spread Krishna consciousness. Okay, so that means, yeah, chanting Hare Krishna, hearing about Krishna, and working to spread Krishna consciousness. So, some way you're chanting, so japas, you're always the most important activity. Then hearing about Krishna, you know, sitting together, either reading yourself, sitting with others, hearing about Krishna and that. And then working to spread Krishna consciousness, something that then pushes forward the movement, your own development, others' development, somehow or another, so people can take advantage. Prabhupada continued to accelerate. After the first initiations and the first marriage, he was eager for the next step. He was pleased by what he had, but he wanted to do more. It was the greed of the Vaishnava, not a greed to have sense gratification, but to make more and more for Krishna. He would, quote, go in like a needle and come out like a plow, end quote. That is to say, from a small, seemingly insignificant beginning, he would expand his movement to tremendous proportions. At least, that was his desire. He was not content with his newfound success and security at 26 Second Avenue, but was yearning to increase ISKCON as far as possible. This had always been his vision, and he had written it into the ISKCON Charter, quote, to achieve real unity and peace in the world, within the members and humanity at large. Swamiji gathered his group together. He knew that once they tried it, they would love it. But it would only happen if he personally went with them. Washington Square Park was only half a mile away, maybe a little bit more. Ravinder Sarup. He never made a secret of what he was doing. He used to say, I want everyone to know what we are doing. Then one day, D-Day came. He said, we are going to chant in Washington Square Park. Everybody was scared. You don't just go into a park and chant. It seemed like a weird thing to do. But he assured us, saying, you won't be afraid when you start chanting. Krishna will help you. And so he trudged down to Washington Square Park. But we were very upset about it. Up until that time, we weren't exposing ourselves. I was upset about it, and I know that several other people were, to be making a public figure of yourself. With Prabhupada leading, they set out on the fair Sunday morning, walking the city blocks from Second Avenue to Washington Square, in the heart of Greenwich Village. And the way he looked, just by walking, he created a sensation. None of the boys had shaved heads or robes, but because of Swamiji with his saffron robes, his white pointy shoes, and his shaven head held high, people were astonished. It wasn't like when he would go out alone. That brought nothing more than an occasional second glance. But today, with a group of young men hurrying to keep up with him as he headed through the city streets, obviously about to do something, he caused a stir. Tough guys and kids called out names, and others laughed and made sounds. A year ago in Butler, the Agarwals had been sure that Prabhupada had not come to America for followers. He didn't want to make any waves, Sally had thought, but now he was making waves, walking through the New York City streets, headed for the first public chanting in America, followed by his first disciples. Right? Because if you're in a situation where you don't have any standing or anything, then you're very careful what you do. You don't want to bother people in that because you're dependent upon them and all that. So then if you're dependent, then you have to be, you know, reciprocate properly. But now he has his own scene, his own thing, so he's not dependent. So now he can go out and, you know, make waves. In the park, there were hundreds of people milling about. Stylish, decadent Greenwich villagers, visitors from other boroughs, tourists and from other states and other lands, an amalgam of faces, nationalities, ages, and interests. Right, the boroughs, New York is divided up into boroughs, like the different areas within the, around the city are called boroughs. Why, I'm not sure, maybe because that's what, you know, animals, you know, dig a hole in the ground and go in there. That's called a burrow, whatever it is. So maybe that's why, you know, where the various animals live. You know, you have your Queens, you know, animals, and you have your Bronx animals. Those are the toughest. Then you have your Brooklyn animals. Then you have your, I forget all the different places like that, but those are the ones. As usual, someone was playing his guitar by the fountain. Boys and girls were sitting together and kissing. Some were throwing frisbees. Some were playing drums or flutes or other instruments. And some were walking their dogs, talking, watching everything, wandering about. It was a typical day in the village. Prabhupada went to a patch of lawn there, despite a small sign that read, "Keep off the grass." Many people were lounging. He sat down. And one by one, his followers sat beside him. He took out his brass hand cymbals and sang the Maha Mantra. And his disciples responded, awkwardly at first, then stronger. It wasn't as bad as they had thought it would be. Jagannath. It was a marvelous thing, a marvelous experience that Swamiji brought upon me, because it opened me up a great deal, and I overcame a certain shyness. The first time to chant out in the middle of everything. A curious crowd gathered to watch, although no one joined in. Within a few minutes, two policemen moved in through the crowd. "Who's in charge here?" an officer asked roughly. The boys looked towards Prabhupada. "Don't you see the sign?" an officer asked. Swamiji furrowed his brow and turned his eyes towards the sign. He got up and walked to the uncomfortably warm pavement and sat down again. And his followers straggled after him to sit around him. Prabhupada continued the chanting for half an hour, and the crowd stood listening. A guru in America had never gone into the streets before and sung the names of God. Yeah, so the picture that you see of Prabhupada sitting, I think that was Tompkins Square Park. That's another park. It's a little smaller. It's not as big as Washington's always the one. Washington's always the one you see in the movies and that. It's the one with the big arch and the fountain. That one. That. When they do Hari Nams, the devotees always start at Washington Square and then go out from there. So the picture that you see of Prabhupada doing kirtan, it's taken across, so it looks like he's sitting on the grass, but he's not. He's actually sitting on the pavement. Like that, because the sign says keep off the grass, so no one's on the grass like that. Of course, unfortunately, the hippies didn't quite catch the keep off the grass part, but whatever. After kirtan, he asked for a copy of the Srimad Bhagavatam and had Hayagriva read aloud from the preface. With clear articulation, Hayagriva read, "Disparity in the human society is due to the basic principle of a godless civilization. There is God, the Almighty One, from whom everything emanates, by whom everything is maintained, and in whom everything is merged to rest." The crowd was still. Afterwards, the Swami and his followers walked back to the storefront, feeling elated and victorious. They had broken the American silence. Allen Ginsberg lived nearby on East 10th Street. One day he received a particular invitation in the mail. So from the invitation. "Practice the transcendental sound vibration. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. This chanting will cleanse the dust from the mirror of the mind." International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Meetings at 7 a.m. daily, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 7 p.m. You are cordially invited to come and bring your friends. Swamiji had asked the boys to distribute it around the neighborhood. One evening, soon after he received the invitation, Allen Ginsberg and his roommate, Peter Orlovsky arrived at the storefront in a Volkswagen minibus. Well, that was like the, how you'd say, the iconic hippie vehicle would be the Volkswagen minibus. Alan had been captivated by the Hare Krishna mantra several years before, when he had first encountered it at the Kumbh Mela festival in Allahabad, India, and he had been chanting it often ever since. The devotees were impressed to see the world-famous author of Howl and leading figure of the Beat Generation and enter their humble storefront. His advocation of free sex, marijuana, and LSD, his claims of drug-induced visions of spirituality in everyday sights, his political ideas, his exploration of insanity, revolt, and nakedness, and his attempts to create a harmony of like-minded souls, all were influential in the minds of American young people, especially those living on the Lower East Side. Although by middle-class standards he was scandalous and disheveled, he was, in his own right, a figure of worldly repute, more so than anyone who had ever come into the storefront before. Allen Ginsberg. Bhaktivedanta seemed to have no friends in America. He was all alone, totally alone, and gone somewhat like a lone hippie to the nearest refuge, the place where it was cheap enough to rent. There were a few people sitting cross-legged on the floor. I think most of them were Lower East Side hippies who had just wandered in off the street with beards and a curiosity and inquisitiveness and a respect for spiritual presentation of some kind. Some of them were sitting there with glazed eyes, but most of them were just like gentlefolk, bearded, hip, and curious. They were refugees from the middle class on the Lower East Side, looking exactly like the street sadhus in India. It was very similar, that phase in American underground history. And I liked it, and I liked immediately the idea that Swami Bhaktivedanta had chosen the Lower East Side of New York for his practice. He'd gone to the lower depths. He'd gone to a spot more like the side streets of Calcutta than any other place. Alan and Peter had come for the kirtan, but it wasn't quite time. Prabhupada hadn't come down. They presented a new harmonium to the devotees. "It's for the kirtan," said Alan, "a little donation." Alan stood at the entrance to the storefront, talking with Hayagriva, telling him how he had been chanting Hare Krishna around the world, at peace marches, poetry readings, a procession in Prague, a writer's union in Moscow. "Secular kirtan," said Alan, "but Hare Krishna nonetheless." When Prabhupada entered, Alan and Peter sat with the congregation and joined in the kirtan. Alan played harmonium. "Alan, I was astonished that he'd come with the chanting because it seemed like a reinforcement from India. I had been running around singing Hare Krishna, but had never understood exactly why or what it meant. But I was surprised to see that he had a different melody because I thought the melody I knew was the melody, the universal melody. I had gotten so used to my melody that actually the biggest difference I had with him was over the tune, because I'd solidified it in my mind for years, and to hear another tune actually blew my mind." After the lecture, Alan came forward to meet Prabhupada. It also shows that, you know, whatever it is that you can chant nicely, then that's all that needs to be done. It's not that it's a fancy tune that makes it work or that. Because like here, Allen Ginsberg had one tune. He was very famous, you know, in these people who are into something different, something unique, this and that. He had one tune. And that one tune he had been singing for years. And so he was actually shocked that there was a second tune. Like that, you know. And Prabhupada, he'd also just sing in, you know, this one basic tune. Like that. So it's not actually the doing fancy melodies and all that. Like most of those who are really good at kirtan and that, they have a variety of tunes much of the time because they're so absorbed, and they, you know, with time they find newer and newer, you know, tunes and that are very nice for devotees to chant and all that. But one actually who's very famous in kirtan and bhajan, he always uses the same tune in that. You see that, like Indradyumna Maharaj. He uses these old tunes, but he sings them so sweetly that you don't think it doesn't matter. Because that's the point. The name doesn't require a fancy tune to be attractive like that. Does that make sense? The name is, welcome back. After the lecture, Alan came forward to meet Prabhupada, who was still sitting on his dais. Alan offered his respect with folded palms and touched Prabhupada's feet, and Prabhupada reciprocated by nodding his head and folding his palms. They talked together briefly, and then Prabhupada returned to his apartment. Alan mentioned to Hayagriva that he would like to come by again and talk more with Prabhupada, so Hayagriva invited him to come the next day and stay for lunch prasadam. "Don't you think Swamiji is a little too esoteric for New York?" Alan asked. Hayagriva thought. "Maybe," he replied. So esoteric means it's like very lofty, very subtle, very, difficult to understand. So here is your most famous head saying that, isn't he esoteric? Because heads are into esoteric. Right? That's what they're called, heads, because they're in their head, what's going on. That. So for him to say that, then that means then he was even over their heads, right? Hayagriva then asked Alan to help the Swami. Since his visa would soon expire, he had entered the country with a visa for a 2-month stay, and he'd been extending his visa for 2 more months again and again. This had gone on for 1 year, but the last time he had applied for an extension, he had been refused. "We need an immigration lawyer," and said Hayagriva. "I'll donate to that," Alan assured him. The next morning, Allen Ginsberg came by with a check and another harmonium. Up in Prabhupada's apartment, he demonstrated his melody for chanting Hare Krishna. And then he and Prabhupada talked. "Alan, I was a little shy with him because I didn't know where he was coming from. I had that harmonium I wanted to donate, and I had a little money. I thought it was great now that he was here to expound on the Hare Krishna mantra. That would sort of justify my singing. I knew what I was doing, but I didn't have any theological background to satisfy further inquiries. And here was someone who did. So I thought that was absolutely great. Now I could go around singing Hare Krishna, and if anybody wanted to know what it was, I could just send them to Swami Bhaktivedanta to find out. If anyone wanted to know the technical intricacies and the ultimate history, I could send them to him." So it's like he could just sing, and then if somebody had a question, you talk to Swami Bhaktivedanta. So that's good for us. But it worked good both ways. He explained to me about his own teacher and about Chaitanya and the lineage going back. His head was filled with so many things and what he was doing. He was already working on his translations. He always seemed to be sitting there just day after day, night after night. And I think he had one or two people helping him. Prabhupada was very cordial with Alan. Quoting a passage from Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says that whatever a great man does, others will follow. He requested Alan to continue chanting Hare Krishna at every opportunity so that others would follow his example. He told about Lord Chaitanya's organizing the first civil disobedience movement in India, leading a Sankirtan protest against the Muslim ruler. Alan was fascinated. He enjoyed talking with the Swami. Right, so cordial, is very pleasant, nice, very accommodating, trying to make the other person feel very comfortable and everything like that. So that's the way one deals. But they had their differences. When Alan expressed his admiration for a well-known Bengali holy man, Prabhupada said that the holy man was bogus. Alan was shocked. He had never before heard a Swami severely criticize another's practice. Prabhupada explained, on the basis of Vedic evidence, the reasoning behind his criticism. And Alan admitted that he had naively thought that all holy men were 100% holy. But now he decided that he should not simply accept the sadhu, including Prabhupada, on blind faith. He decided to see Prabhupada in a more severe, critical light. So it goes, that's the problem with these things, is that you either accept everybody or accept nobody. So that the standard, in other words, of the pious, you know, persons, is therefore everybody is seen as advanced, right? You come in like Hindu, then all sadhus are nice, you know, so they can't handle criticism of everybody, because everybody's good, right? Because if you don't follow that one, then the other comes as this one, is that then everybody is somebody to doubt, and they have to prove themselves. But who are you to understand that, and how do you know what's the criterion by which you can judge, right? So since the Hindus understand they don't have the qualification to judge, therefore they don't judge and put everyone in an elevated position. Problem is the Westerners think that they are qualified, you know, to understand everything and all that. So therefore, they put everybody, you start at the bottom, and then you have to work your way up. Well, the Indian is you start at the top, and then you can work your way down, you know, by bad behavior or something. Right? You understand? So one should discriminate, but one should always start, culturally by dealing nicely with the person, like that. Then if they prove themselves otherwise, then you make adjustments in how you deal with them. But you always deal nicely, and then adjust it according to what is actually the person's position. Does that make sense? So it's a combination of both. You know, proper culture and discrimination. Alan, I had a very superstitious attitude of respect, which probably was an idiot sense of mentality. And so Swami Bhaktivedanta's teachings was very good to make me question that. It also made me question him and not take him for granted. Alan described a divine vision he had had in which William Blake had appeared to him in sound, and in which he had understood the oneness of all things. Not sure who William Blake is, but
I think he's
a writer. One of these famous. Okay. A sadhu in Vrindavan had told Alan that this meant that William Blake was his guru. Oh my God! Indian sadhus are too much. But to Prabhupada, this made no sense. Alan, the main thing above and beyond all our differences was an aroma of sweetness that he had. A personal, selfless sweetness, like total devotion. And that was what always conquered me. Whatever intellectual questions or doubts I had, or even cynical views of ego, in his presence there was a kind of personal charm, coming from dedication, that conquered all our conflicts. Even though I didn't agree with him, I always liked to be with him. Alan agreed, at Prabhupada's request, to chant more and try to give up smoking. Do you really intend to make these American boys into Vaishnavas? Alan asked. Yes, Prabhupada replied happily, and I will make them all Brahmanas. Alan left a $200 check to help cover the legal expenses for extending the Swami's visa and wished him good luck. Brahmanas, Alan didn't see how such a transformation could be possible. It's tough. September 23rd. Right, because Prabhupada's point is society is for creating Brahmanas. Because Brahmanas then will lead the society. From Brahmanas, they will create Kshatriyas. Kshatriyas will create an environment with the Vaishyas, which already exist, will then perform their duties, you know, in a more positive way. Then the shudras, the common people, will be then protected, right? So when the brahmanas are there, the kshatriyas and vaishyas will do their duties properly, and then everybody will be benefited, right? So everything will work very smoothly in that way. So that's the first thing, is to create a class of brahmanas. So that means persons who know Brahman, right? Brahmana means one who knows Brahman. That means those who know the philosophy and culture of Krishna consciousness and who can train others in that. Right? Who practice it and train others in that. Yes? No? Right. September 23rd. It was Radhastami, the appearance day of Srimati Radharani, Lord Krishna's eternal consort. Prabhupada held his second initiation. Right, so this is just after 2 weeks. So all this has happened in 2 weeks. So in 2 weeks, he's done his first initiations. Then he did the marriage ceremony. Then Harinam. Then distributing all these pamphlets, Allen Ginsberg came and made arrangements for Prabhupada's visa and everything like that. And now, the second initiation. So there was a lot going on, a lot happening. Keith became Kirtanananda. Steve became Satsvarup. Bruce became Brahmananda. And Chuck became Achutananda. Okay, Chuck Achutananda. It was another festive day with a fire sacrifice in Prabhupada's front room and a big feast. Right? So even though these were the first ones, somehow or another, due to the way it worked out, they actually were on the second initiation. But I mean, it's only 2 weeks apart. But Prabhupada lived amid the drug culture in a neighborhood where the young people were almost desperately attempting to alter their consciousness, whether by drugs or by some other means. Whatever was available. Prabhupada assured them that they could easily achieve the higher consciousness they desired by chanting Hare Krishna. It was inevitable that in explaining Krishna consciousness, he would make allusions to the drug experience. Even if only to show that the two were contrary paths. He was familiar already with Indian sadhus, so-called sadhus, who took ganja and hashish on the plea of aiding their meditations. And even before he had left India, hippie tourists had become a familiar sight on the streets of Delhi. The hippies liked India because of the cultural mystique and easy access to drugs. They would meet their Indian counterparts, who assured them that taking hashish was spiritual, and they would return to America and perpetuate their misconception of Indian spiritual culture. It was the way of life. The local head shops carried a full line of paraphernalia. Marijuana, LSD, peyote, cocaine, and hard drugs like heroin and barbiturates were easily purchased on the streets and in the parks. Underground newspapers reported important news on the drug scene, featuring a cartoon character named Captain High, and ran crossword puzzles that only a seasoned head could answer. Yeah. Prabhupada had to teach that Krishna consciousness was beyond the revered LSD trip. Do you think taking LSD can produce ecstasy in higher consciousness? He once asked his storefront audience. Then just imagine a room full of LSD. Krishna consciousness is like that. he says, you're taking this little pill, and if you think that's getting you somewhere, imagine if it was one full room full of this stuff. Then you're talking, the difference, People would regularly come in and ask Swamiji's disciples, do you get high from this? And the devotees would answer, oh yes, you can get high just by chanting. Why don't you try it? Greg Shroff, Brahmananda's brother. Many of you maybe have met Greg. Hadn't tried LSD, but he wanted higher consciousness, so he decided to try the chanting. Greg, I was 18. Everyone at the storefront had taken LSD. And I thought maybe I should too, because I wanted to feel like part of the crowd. So I asked Umapati, hey, Umapati, do you think I should try LSD? Because I don't know what you guys are talking about. He said, no, that Swamiji said you don't need LSD. I never did take it, so I guess it was okay. According to the legal, legal laws in America, that if you've taken LSD 7 times, you can actually be classified as clinically insane, like that. So he didn't take. So he said, "I guess I was okay." Yeah. He was quite okay. Right? Hayagriva, have you ever heard of LSD? It's a psychedelic drug that comes like a pill, and if you take it, you can get some religious ecstasies. Do you think this can help my spiritual life? Prabhupada, You don't need to take anything for your spiritual life. Your spiritual life is already there. Had anyone else said such a thing, Hayagriva would never have agreed with him. But because Swamiji seemed so absolutely positive, therefore there was no question of not agreeing. Yeah, because others were, well, you know, this, that, and, you know, maybe like this. But Prabhupada just said, no, you don't need it. It's already there. Spiritual life's already there, just the soul has to recognize it, has to take it up. Satsuru, I knew Swamiji was in a state of exalted consciousness, and I was hoping that somehow he could teach the process to me in the privacy of his room. I asked him, is there spiritual advancement that you can make from which you don't fall back? By his answer, yes, I was convinced that my own attempts to be spiritual on LSD, only to fall down later, could be replaced by a total spiritual life such as Swamiji had. I could see he was convinced, and then I was convinced. Greg, LSD was like the spiritual drug of the times, and Swamiji was the only one who dared to speak out against it, saying it was nonsense. I think that was the first battle he had to conquer in trying to promote his movement on the Lower East Side. Even those who came regularly to the storefront thought that LSD was good. So that was Prabhupada's point. So going there, he wasn't interested in what's, you know, everybody thinks, what's politically correct. His point was, is, you know, what's correct is correct. It's Krishna has established it. And so if you follow that, then everything works, because that's actually the way it is. That's the reality. So he wasn't worried that here, right in the middle of the, you know, the hip culture and all that, that, you know, LSD was so central to it. He didn't care. He'd just say, speak against it. They come up with all these Indian sadhus. He'd say they're nonsense, you know, because, you know, he'd just speak the truth. But it didn't have any other motive. He wasn't trying to prove himself or make himself more important than others. He was simply establishing that this is what the truth is. Right? Well, others would be, it's their ego that they're trying to establish. But here it's, no, this is just the truth. Probably the most famous experiments with LSD in those days were by Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, Harvard psychology instructors who studied the effects of the drug, published their findings in professional journals, and advocated the use of LSD for self-realization and fulfillment. After being fired from Harvard, I wonder why, Timothy Leary went on to become a national priest of LSD, and for some time ran an LSD commune in Millbrook, New York. When the members of the Millbrook commune heard about the Swami on the Lower East Side, who led his followers in a chant that got you high, they began visiting the storefront. One night, a group of about 10 hippies from Millbrook came to Swamiji's kirtan. They all chanted, not so much in worship of Krishna, as to see what kind of high the chanting would produce. And after the lecture, a Millbrook leader asked about drugs. Pa replied that drugs were not necessary for spiritual life, that they could not produce spiritual consciousness, and that all drug-induced religious visions were simply hallucinations. To realize God was not so easy or cheap that one could do it just by taking a pill or smoking. Chanting Hare Krishna, he explained, was a purifying process to uncover one's pure consciousness. Taking drugs would increase the covering and bar one from self-realization. But have you ever taken LSD? The question now became a challenge. No, Prabhupada replied. I have never taken any of these things, not even cigarettes or tea. If you haven't taken it, then how can you say what it is? The Millbrookers looked around, smiling. Two or three even burst out with laughter, and they snapped their fingers, thinking the Swami had been checkmated. I have not taken, Prabhupada replied, regally from his dais, but my disciples have taken all these things, marijuana, LSD, many times, and they have given them up. You can hear from them. Hayagriva, you can speak. And Hayagriva sat up a little and spoke out in his stentorian best. Well, no matter how high you go on LSD, you eventually reach a peak, and then you have to come back down. Just like traveling into outer space in a rocket ship. He gave one of Swamiji's familiar examples. Your spacecraft can travel very far away from the Earth, for thousands of miles, day after day. But it cannot simply go on traveling and traveling. Eventually, it must land. On LSD, we experience going up, but we always have to come down again. That's not spiritual consciousness. When you actually attain spiritual or Krishna consciousness, you stay high. Because you go to Krishna, you don't have to come down. You can stay high forever. Yeah. Because the point is anything else is rooted in the earth, right? Rooted here. So you go out, you have to come back here. But Krishna consciousness is not rooted here. It's rooted in the spiritual realm. So it's just a matter of purifying the consciousness so that one is comfortable being situated in that position. Because one is naturally, that's the natural position. It's just Krishna consciousness is covered. Not that you have to create Krishna consciousness. It's just covered. Well, the other one, you're creating something, and then it will end. Anything in the material platform has a beginning, a middle, and an end. But spiritual doesn't. It's eternal. So it's a matter of uncovering the eternal, because we think it's not there. Right? That make sense? Yeah. So the stay high forever became a very famous, what do you call it? Phrase that would be used by the devotees. Prabhupada was sitting in his back room with Hayagriva and Umapati and other disciples. The evening meeting had just ended, and the visitors from Millbrook had gone. "Krishna is so nice, Swamiji," Umapati spoke up. "You just get higher and higher, and you don't come down." Prabhupada smiled. "Yes, that's right." "No more coming down," Umapati said, laughing. And the others also began to laugh. Some clapped their hands, repeating, "No more coming down." The conversation inspired Hayagriva and Umapati to produce a new handbill. This is the handbill. Stay high forever, no more coming down. Practice Krishna consciousness. Expand your consciousness by practicing the transcendental sound vibration. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. The leaflet went on to extol Krishna consciousness over any other high. It included phrases like end all bring downs and turn on. And it spoke against employing artificially induced methods of self-realization and expanded consciousness. Someone objected to the flyers playing too much off the hippie mentality, but Prabhupada said it was all right. Because it was using all their terminologies and their things like that. But Prabhupada said, no, it's okay. Because that's where they were all at anyway. Like that. Okay, and here. Om Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.